holy land, the holy city.
And any special news to give us from the holy city?
Tova ha'aretz ma'od ma'od. The land is wonderful, absolutely wonderful. And coming back is also wonderful. So I'm glad to once again resume this shiur. I was told that the shiur has been heard in the Holy Land, somehow through the online magic. Dallas. As I always say, my mistakes are broadcast internationally in real time. So that's the way it is today. As a matter of fact, I was also told that I gave a shiur on this past Sunday in the Holy City, in the Nativ Aryeh, and it's also online somewhere in YU Torah or something. These things go across the ocean in both directions. So you have to be so careful what you say these days. So I feel a little bit bad that I'm not saying things the way they should be.
How about the question?
Well,
they don't show up as well.
The questions are usually anonymous because I certainly don't mention their last name. So anyway. As I said last time, I would like to refer to this beautiful sefer. This is a sefer called Hegyone HaParsha, which is Rabbi Wasserman, a son-in-law of the Nussbaums. And it was brought to my attention last week, 2 weeks ago, that is a lengthy kuntris in the back, Binyan Kol B'Isha Erva, by Rabbi Wasserman. And when I say lengthy, I mean lengthy. On a simple, it's the whole, the three words, Kol B'Isha Erva. How much are you going to talk about three words? Do you want to know how much? It goes, 86 pages, that's how much. Okay? Three words, the whole thing, Kol B'Isha, what could be already? I'm going to give you some of the highlights of this fascinating kuntris before we go into today's topic, which is the Jewish wedding. He suggests that, according to most authorities, the Kol Isha problem is a rabbinical problem, not a Doraisa, a Torah problem. He discusses the question about the speaking voice of a woman, and the assumption is that, generally speaking, sorry, that's a bad pun, but generally, the speaking voice of a woman is not a problem unless it's meant in some kind of an erotic or arousing fashion. Then even the speaking voice of a woman could be a halachic problem, which is called by the Gemara Masechta Kiddushin Kol B'Isha Erva. Now, literally, Kol B'Isha Erva means the voice of a woman is considered Erva. Erva means immoral. Question, of course, becomes, is it intrinsically immoral? Will it lead to immoral behavior? Which of the two is it? We mentioned briefly last time, this should depend upon the classical question, what is the halachic status of a woman who is not considered in our language to be an erva?
Wouldn't you translate erva as nakedness, not immoral?
I translate things somewhat euphemistically, but if you want to look in the...
I think there's a big difference. I mean, because morality, I think there are other words for it, but like... it's something that we're not allowed to see.
Well, you can't see someone's voice.
Right.
That's what Har Sinai, this week's Parsha. That was an exception.
Right, but just like you can't look at something that should be covered, you know, like you can't hear something that should be covered.
Okay, well, take it. I accept it. In any event, the question is, what about a woman who is not, in the halachic parlance, considered to be an erva? In other words, she is a single woman. She's not yet reached the state of Nida. May you hear her singing voice. It's a major dispute between the great giants of the halakhic literature. It should depend, in my view, on this very, very issue. If a female singing voice in and of itself will lead to improper thoughts, doesn't matter. It's a difference if it's a, what kind of, who, it's totally irrelevant. The voice itself is the problem. If, however, the issue is that the voice can be seductive and lead to immoral behavior, then it depends how immoral the behavior really is, how strong an obligation, a violation it really is. And if the woman is single and before her puberty, although it is certainly a strict violation, it does not rise to the level of what we'll call a erva in the full sense of being what we call Korates, for example, of a woman who was either married or a woman who was in a state of nida. These are all much more serious violations if they should take place. And it's possible that only in such instances is the violation of Kol V'Isha applicable. This would presumably include a non-Jewish woman, even though the non-Jewish woman is no formal violation of Kares in the Torah itself. But if a man marries out to a non-Jewish woman, it's what the Gemara calls Kares Midivrei Kabbalah, based upon a pasuk in Navi, and therefore for this reason it's assumed that the violation exists in that situation as well. Okay, so we assume that there's a prohibition against hearing the voice of a woman, the exception being a woman who is single and not a nida. Since women don't go to the mikveh today, it would have to be limited to under the age of 12. Sons Rav Moshe, to play it safe, says 11, because we don't know exactly. Okay, so that's what is true about a young girl singing. Okay, what about a choir? So there's a whole, Rabbi Wasserman has a whole piece about choirs. He says some are strict with choirs, some are more lenient with choirs, because you can't pick out any particular voice. There's a dispute. And a few other leniencies to include is what if it's they're singing Shirei Kodesh, Miros Shabbos. So Rabbi Weinberg Zal of Switzerland said that in writing a tshuva to the youth group in Paris after the war, it was such a difficult situation. Maybe in those kinds of cases, you can be relying on these combinations of factors, many voices, and Shirei Kodesh, Miros Shabbos. He accepted a more lenient view, and he was criticized by others, and it all depends, presumably, on the circumstances surrounding the particular situation. Okay, let us go on. Family members. So there are two issues over here. One, as we spoke about in the past, some prohibitions are Kriya Shema related. So if you can't even hear your own wife's voice, even when she's not a nida, when you're saying the Shema, according to the Shulchan Aruch, so why doesn't that apply to Zmiras, Eish Yischayel? So we mentioned last time, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is lenient on this matter. He quotes Rabbi Wasserman, quotes Rabbi Yoshev, is also lenient on this matter with respect to the Zmiros in this kind of a case. There is a dispute in general with respect to a woman when she's a nida. May her husband hear her voice or not, her singing voice? Some say yes, some say no. Rabbi Vadi Yosef says yes. Rabbi Moshe is not sure, says we should better be machmir. It seems to me we have so many chumras that maybe here we can follow Rabbi Vadia, and that a woman is permitted to sing in her husband's presence, even when she's neither. Yes? It's a whole different story. Step families are way beyond the purview of this week's shiur. Perhaps we'll get to it a little bit later on. But suffice to say, we cannot assume a full equation between a biological family and a step family. Now, the question now becomes an interesting question. There are others who disagree on both points. They say that, as I said before, that a woman who's neither cannot sing when her husband is there. And there are those who say that a woman who is even not neither should not be singing when they're singing Zmiras, because the Zmiras should be considered like Kriya Shema. I think we can be lenient on that as well. There's an interesting question about all kinds of questions. How about your sister? So we find with respect to sisters, there are certain leniencies, not the same as a woman who's not as a different kind of a woman. And therefore, it seems to me we can rely upon the opinions which say that a man may hear his sister's voice, because there are various leniencies in other areas of these halachos, and therefore it should be permissible. Of course, as here too, you can find those who are strict, but I think too you can rely upon the more lenient position. Certainly, the voice of a mother and a daughter is no problem whatsoever. And based on what we said before, even when it comes to the Zmiras, there's no problem. Okay, I'm giving you a brief summation of some of the issues. What about recorded voice? It may depend upon the same question we had before. Is it the voice itself which is a problem? So it applies to recording as well. Or is it the issue that the voice may lead to immoral behavior? In which case, it has to be presumably live and not a taped or recorded voice. This relates to someone who's dead. We mentioned that last time. If the recording artist is dead, there should certainly be a should certainly be okay. Although there are poskim who maintain that if you knew the recording artist in her lifetime, you may not hear her voice even if after she's dead. I'm just kidding. What it says in Rabbi Wasserman's collection. What if he sees a picture? I guess this has to do with a movie, a kosher movie, which is an otherwise kosher movie. I'm trying to think of an example. Maybe Mary Poppins. Maybe that's a good example. At least in its original Gilgal. That's what goes on now. They may have redone it in 2010. Who knows what it looked like. But 30, 40 years ago, when there was, I think, a kosher film, but there was a singing voice of Julie Andrews, right? So is that okay or not? So I think it's okay. Because like a recorded voice, said no. Others say disagree. You see a picture. She's on the screen. So again, I'm just giving you, without making any definitive rulings on these things, seems to me that there's room to be lenient. Now here's the next one. Can you hear? I'm almost done, but I just want to give you, it's so fascinating, the collection over here. Can you hear the voice, a speaking voice of a woman? You already thought that was okay, right? But there is a question of a woman speaking in public, a whole discussion. So there's a discussion in the Tshuvas of the Marashal, okay? He gives his yichus, till he's the son of the Rabbanit, the Rebbetzin, Miriam, daughter of Rabbi Shlomo Shapiro, and this Miriam was the Rosh Hashiva. Yeah, yeah. She said halacha to the Bachrim from behind the curtain. I'm just giving you what it says over here. From behind the curtain. So therefore, there are those who say you can't hear a woman speaking unless it's a curtain. Alright? A whole discussion. Could a woman speak in public?
Isn't that something that's in the Gemara?
What's that? I don't know the Gemara. I'm only quoting from the Shuvas Marashal. I don't know. I'm just unaware. So there are a whole discussion about this issue. So there are poskim who are more lenient. Even in Bnei Brak, believe it or not. That if there's a Rabbi Gestetner, the Horos Nason, suggests a little bit of a leniency for a woman to speak in public. So there's a whole pilpul about this. Could a woman give a hesped, right? So there's another tshuva by the Shevet Halevi. Some are lenient, some are strict. The leniency is based on a pasuk, right? Kiru lemekononos u'tvoena v'lachachamos shulchu v'tvoena. I think it's a haftorah for Tisha B'Av, if I'm not mistaken. So the Mitzudas David says, listen to the woman who's giving the hesped. And they quote Pasuk and Divrei Yomim, which is the same thing, which indicates that it is, in fact, permissible. And you need it's a Mishnah Ksubis, Mevamim Beis, about a Mikonenes, Mishnah Moed Katan. There are many, many sources which seem to say that it is, in fact, permissible. Yes? Right, very good. So there are those who disagree from Mekonenes, and they say the Mekonenes was just, scream out, oi, gewalt,
dirges,
and no one's looking at them, as opposed to the woman giving a hesped, that all the men are looking at her. So that's an issue which the post can talk about. When I grew up, there were women never gave a spaden. Never heard of such a thing. And today, in some circles, it's par for the course. Depends on the circle you're in. If it's par for the course, it's okay. If it's not par for the course, then it shouldn't be done. Now, these are important examples. I want to cut it short because it's just too much to get into. But suffice to say that one of the sources, I'll end with this, about this issue, is the beginning of Shira's Devora, which we read about this morning. Vatosha Devora uBarak Ben Avinon. So those who want to say, you see from here that two voices are okay. And there are many refutations to this. Number one, Fatosha could mean not a singing voice, but a voice of,
recitation.
A recitation voice. Doesn't mean they were speaking. And there are many other different, I refer you to the Hegyone HaParsha. We go through this at great length. Okay? Just want to give a little bit of a nachas to our own shul that we have such an important person. I took mine from home. I didn't know that Ronnie would bring his. I bought the shoes. Okay, remind me to take it out so I shouldn't lose it. It's inscribed, but I don't want to, by mistake, get it lost. It's a very good sefer. As are its two predecessors. Now we're talking about the Jewish wedding. We'll discuss first the classical Jewish wedding, and then we may talk about some of the more avant-garde Jewish weddings and see how this works. So, when some years back I was asked to give a shiur to rabbinical students about how to conduct what we call a Torah wedding. And so I'm using my notes, syllabus, as a basis to a springboard for discussion about a Jewish wedding. Now, a Jewish wedding has what we call in our language a Mesader Kiddushin, literally one who arranges the wedding. It's a rabbinical term that the person who's Mesader Kiddushin is the one who's sort of in charge. Now, there are different ways to view this this role. Some take it very, very seriously. If I'm put in charge of an important event, so I'm in charge from the beginning to the end to make sure it gets done right. Others are much more laid back. They'll come in, they'll say, I have two brachas, and they'll walk away, and then things just go on their own. So I happen to belong to the first group, and that's why I'm careful to meet with a chassan and kala before the wedding and to go over some basics with them, which we'll go over with you right now. The first thing I tell to the chassan and kala is, when they ask me to do a wedding, is, you know what? I'm happy to pass on the honor to somebody else. I've seen too many times when rabbis are fighting about who should have the honor of the Siddur Kiddushin. It used to be, maybe still is in some circles, financially rewarding. We can understand they're not fighting about COVID, they're fighting about money. Okay. But in either event, whether they're fighting about COVID or money, it's very unseemly. And therefore, I've always told people, give it to somebody else. And you know what? People have often taken me up on it. Not that often. Oh, yeah. Okay, Rabbi, we'll do it. It just happened to me not long ago. It was this past spring when I said, you know, may I give it to somebody else? So they said, no, I'm going to do it. And they called me back the next day, a day later. You know, we thought about it again. It's a grandfather, and he would like him. I said, fine. As I said, once I was called, after I was agreed to go, I said, is it okay if it's a certain Rebbe does it? I said, fine. It's fine. I don't need it. As you, I'll explain to you in a minute why I'm very happy not to be Mesader Kiddushin. For me, Mesader Kiddushin is not a matter of honor. It's a matter of tremendous time commitment. Because if I'm Mesader Kiddushin, I try to come early and leave at the end. That's many, many, many hours. Usually at a wedding, I come. I know when to come. I know when to leave. I'm still there a few hours, but not so many hours. So I'm very happy not to be Mesader Kiddushin. Just for the record, in case you have people. A little word, he's going to be insult this one, insult that one. So I'm making a public statement. I'm not insulted if anyone does not ask me Mesader Kiddushin. I don't need it. Baruch Hashem. I do say that you have to make sure that the wedding is a kosher wedding, in the sense that he can marry her. The assignment ultimately falls to the Mesader Kiddushin. He's the one that puts his stamp of approval on the suitability of this couple. And there are many people who are not permitted to marry each other. I mean, I ask three questions right away, three which are really two. Are there any conversions, adoptions, or divorces in the family? I guess it's a standard question I ask to everybody. The reason for conversions and adoptions are usually conversions these days, is because we're not so sure if the conversion is valid. This is time for part of a different discussion, a discussion of who is a convert, the whole conversion controversy of these days. Not to go into that in detail, but at the end of the day, it's the responsibility of the rabbi, his Mesader Kiddushin, to make this determination. And he has to do the research. You have to find out. If someone is, in fact, converted, that's fine. We love all converts. V'haftim es ager. Anyone who marries a convert is getting so many mitzvahs. He loves his wife, so he has a haftim. It's a bonus. Get an extra mitzvah every single day. V'haftim es ager. But you have to make sure that the conversion is proper. And the one that has to do that is the rabbi who's performing the ceremony. The fact that A, B, or C said so in the past is irrelevant. Because you know how the word goes, people just say things and they're not careful about them. It's the rabbi Mesader Kiddushin who has the ultimate responsibility. And divorces, of course, the problem is, in case there was a divorce without a proper get, then the woman, it's a serious problem. For the woman herself, or for the mother of husband or or the wife, we run into a problem of chas shalom of mamzerus, of an illegitimate child who cannot marry, may not marry. So it becomes very problematic. That's for every couple. If the man is a kohen, it makes things much more complicated. Because if the man is a kohen, there are other women he's not permitted to marry. Aside from divorcees, he may not marry. He may not marry a convert. He may not marry a woman who had lived with a non-Jewish man. So that's a whole story. For a kohen, it's even more complicated. It's the rabbi's responsibility. He has to take care of it. There's nobody else. It's his responsibility. Fine. The rabbi has to give his consent to when the marriage should take place. You know, there's issues of sfira, the 3 weeks, etc. Where it should take place. Can they place in a shul? Should it be what's called under the skylight, or they have a skylight in the building? Do you need that? Do you not need that? Setting the date. The rabbi should be consulted. There are issues of nida, and all kinds of issues which relate to the cycle and various pills that are being taken. There's something on why you Torah about that too, which I co-authored with Dr. Greyjow. I recommend that you look at that. It's very important. I'm only the rabbi. He's the doctor. Our approach is different than what's done by most OBGYNs, and so far, to my knowledge, it's always worked, whereas the one used by the typical OBGYN, it does not always work. Not the time to talk about the details right now. Consult the article if you'd like. But the rabbi's job is to see to it that both the chassan and the kallah are properly educated in these laws. Now that, again, it's his responsibility. He has to see to it that it gets done. Okay, now we get to the wedding itself. So the wedding, a wedding consists of a number of stages. The first stage of the wedding is formally now, the actual wedding proper, is what we call kiddushin. Erusin. Those are synonymous terms, or identical terms. Just one is different, one is the rabbinic Hebrew, one is biblical Hebrew. It's hard to translate. It really is. The typical translation is betrothal. I'm not sure what betrothal means. I think it means kiddushin and erusin. I don't know whether that's any independent meaning whatsoever. Which is good, since no one knows what it means. We'll just take it as what it means. What it means is an eshes ish bebeis avia, a married woman who's living in her father's home. Which means she's not moved in with her husband yet. She's still living in a parental home. But she's a full eshes ish. So much so that if she lives with another man, so it's a very, very serious violation. It's a full adulterous violation. And if she's a nara, it's even more strict. Nara marosa, schayv skil, it's even more than another adulterous act. So it's a very serious stage. It's not engagement. I very rarely, almost never, will correct another rabbi, you know, who's not my talmid, not one of my talmidim. I just couldn't. I felt it was important. A very significant rabbi gets up and he's explaining the whole system. We'll have the first stage, and the first stage is called kiddushin, and that's engagement. Now it's true in modern Hebrew, muasim means engaged, but that's a corruption, and it's if you put it in the newspapers, you know, and have all the Haredi papers. A and B on Mu'urasim, everyone knows it means that it's just they're engaged. Not everyone knows what it means. But in front of an audience, which included quite a few people who were not so learned, and he says that we have the first stage of the Erusin, which is called engagement. I said to him afterwards, you didn't really mean that, because Erusin, if a woman would commit adultery after Erusin, it would be a capital offense, in theory. As opposed to someone who's engaged, engagement has almost no halachic status. So I felt I had to just tell them that it was just not the way to translate the word. Okay, that's the first stage. This status of erusin or kiddushin can only be effective in the presence of two kosher witnesses. If you ask what's the greatest honor to receive at a wedding, the kibbutzim, the greatest honor is to be called up as an aid kiddushin. That means you're a kosher Jew. Everything else, an aid kiddushin is very, very important. That's the most important of all, because you are the ones, what we call Eide Kiyum. You are not just witnessing it, but you're in effect creating it as one of the witnesses. If you're not there, it doesn't happen. And we discussed at the Shia this afternoon what happens in a case in which there is a problem with one of the Eidim, which is discovered later on. They made a mistake. One of the Edom who was designated was not a kosher Edom, but there were other Edom there. A big dispute between the various rabbis as to what kind of status it has. Again, not going into it right now, but it's important, if you want the wedding to be a valid wedding, to make sure that the Edom, in fact, are kosher witnesses. The Ksuba, which precedes, the Ksuba is a marriage contract that's written before in America before the Kiddushin, also has Edom. They should also be kosher, but it's not the same level of significance. In other words, if the Edom and the Ksuba is no good, you know, the marriage is a marriage, and a Ksuba today is not as important as it used to be, for a simple reason. The reason for a Ksuba was so that the man should not be able to divorce his wife on a whim. It's going to cost the money. No one likes to part with money. Today, since Rabbeinu Gershom was talking about 1,000 years ago, no one can divorce a wife on a whim. As a matter of fact, no one can divorce a wife without her consent. So the whole purpose of Ksuba, as the Gemara puts it, Shalot Kala Be'enav Lo Tzia, he can't just divorce her on a whim, no longer applies. So the Ramah in Ebenezer says that for this reason, really, Ksuba shouldn't really apply nowadays. As in the case of the Torah, in the case of a man who forces himself on a woman, that's called an ones, gives a chamishim shkolim, we'll read in 2 weeks. In that case, there's no need for a ksuba because he can't divorce her against his will. So, the Ramah has some leniencies. We don't do it that way. We insist on a kosher ksuba, but in the back of your mind, it's not as serious as the edim on the kiddush. Fine. So after the again, we signed the ksuba earlier, but they're not married yet, not at all. Then we go to the kiddushin. Between the ksuba and the kiddushin, traditionally we have what we call the badekin. What's the badekin? Badekin literally means to cover. It means in our custom, the chosen takes some kind of a veil and places it over the face of the kala. And there's a whole dispute, what kind of veil, what's the purpose of the veil, what is it supposed to be. In Hasidic circles, the veil is so thick that it's not see-through. No, really. So much so that many rabbis in those circles will pick up the veil to make sure that's the right girl underneath. Not like Lava. You know, you never know who she is. In our circles, the veil's up usually see-through, so there's no need to do that. Again, everything I'm saying now in brief could be spent the whole shiur on, but just try and give a brief synopsis of what's going on at a typical Jewish wedding. So there's a bedekin. Perhaps I'll come back to it a little bit later on. Then they go to the kiddushin. Fine. What is the kiddushin? What does it mean? What does kiddushin mean? So, you know, maybe we better sort of go in order, and then we'll come back to all these things in detail. Whenever there's a wedding, and I'm the Messiah Kedushin, I ask some basic questions to make sure that there's, you know, that the proper dress. Sometimes, you know, brides are not properly dressed these days. So you have to make a statement about it. At least, you know, ask that it should be done properly. I'm a one-man campaign against the tiaras, which look like silver crowns. It's a new style. They never had these things until... it's already 15 years or so that this year.
Well, the Rambam said you shouldn't wear it, so it must have had it. Otherwise, you wouldn't say.
No, they had it, but the Rambam, the Gemara says you can't wear it. There was someone in our shul who I was in Masala Kiddushin, and I went through this list. I said, no tiara. What? The girl's from Flatbush. Everyone wears a tiara. These people are married now 12 and a half years. So I said, but it says in the Shulchan Aruch, I showed it. It says you can't wear it. Well, everyone's wearing it. So I found out that it's not real silver. That's it. It's a bluff. Like most things in life. It's a bluff. It looks like silver, it's not real silver. So that's about what they were relying upon that. But I was nervous. I went to, what I really did, I don't like to paskin like on my own. I took the tea, I went to the house of the bride in Flatbush. I went to her house, took the tiara with me, showed it to a couple of distinguished rabbis, and they said, you know, it's not real silver. Then one of the rabbis called me back after I got home, but if it looks like silver, it's a question of what we call marasayin, and everyone thinks it's going to be silver. So I was, you know, I told the colleague, no, if you really want it, if your heart's set on it, 2 hours in Flatbush said, it's not so bad. She didn't wear it. She said, Rabbi, if you don't want it, I'm not going to wear it. I was so impressed. I said, you want it, you do it. She said, no, I don't want. She didn't wear it. Thank God the couple's been blessed with healthy children and with financial success. I don't attribute all of it to the fact she didn't wear it. But a little bit credit I want to take. I mean, I say she should take it. She was so, you know. Zecher lechurban. It says a churban issue. Since the churban beis hamikdash, that's why. Since the churban beis hamikdash, the destruction of the temple, they made a gzeira against ataros shel chasam v'kal. Simple. It's a gemara. I'm not going to make it up. It's a gemara. Okay, let's go a little further. It's a crown. Tiara is Spanish for crown. Am I right? Again, one of the rabbis, who was a world-renowned posek, said, let's look at our kids' pictures. He takes with his wife, on the fireplace, with 5 beautiful pictures of their sons and daughters, and says, I don't see any tiaras here. Maybe they have a headpiece, whatever they have. It. Nothing looked like silver at all. So
as long as it's not silver, it's not a problem.
Again, but it looks like silver. So
no,
looks,
no, like porcelain.
No, that's no problem. It's clearly some kind of a flat. You're allowed to wear a headband. I mean, that's no question about that. This shouldn't be silver or look like silver. All that glitters.
No, I'm just saying, gold and silver. I mean, I think the thing with the crown, it's supposed to be like a crown.
Well,
can you wear gold and silver?
Well, I guess, I don't know if the Gemara talks about gold explicitly, but gold sounds like it's even more precious than silver, and so diamonds are more precious than gold, so I would stay away from these things as well. Okay. I asked the Chosin and the Kala to make sure that there's no fights. Is it separate seating or mixed seating? I don't care which one they choose. In my opinion, they're both permissible, but it's not permissible, it's fighting. So you have to raise these issues in advance. They don't know what's ahead of them. So I raise the issue, and I always tell people, give in, don't fight about it. The weddings that we had, well, so whatever the other side wanted, that's what we had. Most of the weddings we made for our children were mixed. Some were separate. One of them was both. It was his, hers, and theirs. Whatever. There shouldn't be any fights. But mixed dancing, that's not allowed. You have to put your foot down somewhere. Okay? That's not allowed. Do you need a mechitza? Nowadays, mechitza has become de rigueur. When I got married, there was no mechitza. People didn't have mechitzas. But these days it's popular, and I think it's why it sounds like it's a good
aware.
Between the dance floor of the man and the dance floor of the woman. The men and women shouldn't see. There are always people looking through the mechitza. Okay, but all right. It's. If the woman comes into the chosen side for the classical case of miraculum of Ne'akala, that's a gemara, that's fine. But what I do not like is when the chosen goes to the kala side. Because then he's watching all the girls dancing around with all the gyrations. That's not appropriate. And so I have pulled a chosen out by the kala. Okay. Of course, we discussed the wedding ring, which should be brought by the chosen with his own money. And it should be a plain ring with nothing which looks like stones. Because if it looks like stones, it could be argued she's only agreeing to marry because she's a millionaire, she's stones. So plain wedding ring.
Okay.
No
holes also? No. Holes. Some of them are like lattice. You know, I was told before there should
be holes. I'm not sure why.
I
don't know why. I don't know why either. I don't see why. So, perhaps. Maybe.
It
should be less viable. It's like a bagel. There's air in the middle. I mean, I don't get it. Okay. So now let's go in order. Let's talk a little bit about the tanoim. Goes, you know, in the order of the wedding itself. So tanoim is nothing really the way we have it. Tanoim that we sign today at the wedding, he'll marry her and she'll marry him, and they'll agree that we'll all be nice and fine. And the two fathers pick up a handkerchief. It's a photo op. It's a photo op, and it doesn't really have any meaning in my opinion. But it's a traditional. The mothers break a plate. It's the whole thing. Wonderful. Everyone's happy with it. Why not? More important to me is the marriage license. That is a governmental requirement. A rabbi who performs a wedding without a marriage license in New York State is guilty of a misdemeanor. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, misdemeanor. Okay. Okay. A lot of misdemeanors.
You
ever drive more than 55 miles an hour? I think that's probably also a misdemeanor. We have an attorney here. You can tell me what the difference is between the misdemeanors. I don't know. There was a case, a celebrated case, but I can't go into any names or details, of someone who was married, a man who was married to a non-Jewish woman. So of course in halacha he was never married, but he was very wealthy and was tied up in court for years, because she wanted a nice chunk of his money. I mean, no, why not? So he could not get a civil divorce. And meanwhile, years are going on, and he's dating a Jewish girl, and they got engaged, and they want to get married. So they asked a particular rabbi, and the rabbi asked me. I said, it's a misdemeanor. Can't do it. But in a wrinkle in the law, and we have a couple of lawyers who can tell me next week if I'm wrong, it's only a violation for a clergyman. If you're not a clergyman, there's no violation. So her brother, who's not a clergyman, performed the wedding. Apparently there was no technical violation on his part. Again, I'm not advocating this either. I'm just giving you a story which happened, and our lawyers will tell us what the strict law is. Fine. After the Tanoim,
the guy's probably violating the law because he's getting married without a license.
He's getting married religiously.
But he's getting married in the state of New York without getting a license.
But he's only getting married religiously. He's not getting married civilly.
He's not really married.
Because in the new eyes of the state, he's living with a woman. There are many men that are living with women who are, that's not a violation of New York state law. Not yet, but anyway, maybe, yeah. So ksuba. The ksuba, as we said before, even though it doesn't have the same critical nature as it used to have, it's nothing that must be done right, and you have to have the names properly. That means the chosn and kala's names, and their respective father's names. That's how ksubas are traditionally done. And it can get a little bit hairy. How do you spell names in Hebrew? Many times, you'd be surprised that people spell names in a way which is incorrect. You try to tell them, what? That's how you spell it? I've been spelling my name for 20 years a different way. You can't tell me how to change. Don't tell me how to spell my name. It happened at my wedding. When my Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik told my father-in-law, Allah Shalom, that you've been spelling your daughter's name wrong for the last 20 years. Her name is Fega, and she always held it with two yuds. I said, no, it's with one yud. And ever since then, it's with one yud, because the Rebbe said, the A, it's a Yiddish name. So the problem is there are three vowels, E, A, and I. And there are only two ways to do them, right? With one yud or with two yuds. So E is with one yud, and I is with two yuds. What about A? So Yiddishists spell it with two yuds. All those names, Shana, Bela, Fega, you know, a whole bunch of names like that. Kayla, all of them. But the rabbis decide to spell it more correct with only one yud. So there, that's where, of course, she spells it with an aleph, which is correct. But they also spell it with a hey. Because you know, in many of the Hebrew schools, things have to end with a hey. You know, to be more Zionistic or something. But only Hebrew names end with a hey. Aramaic names, and therefore Yiddish as well, end with an aleph. So therefore, you have to end it with an aleph. There are also issues about what's considered Hebrew, what's Aramaic. We just recently had a situation. The name Talia came to the fore. You know her name Talia? I have a child named Talia? Huh? Granddaughter Talia? So how does she spell it? Okay, so it's a big dispute.
I know in English it's a Y.
Okay, that's fine. But the question is, what's the last letter of the Hebrew name? If it means Talia, you know, we have it in the Gemara, from the word tle, shepsel, right? You know, Talia, that's just spelled with an aleph, like any other Aramaic
that
word. No. Tess. Tle. But some say no, it means talco. It is the dew of God. Wow! I never heard of that one. But despite my protestations, at the most recent case we had, It was on a Gairus document. It wasn't more than that. But after consultation, I was outvoted. You have not to be outvoted. And they spelled it with a hey. Fine. But I'm still a little bit. It depends what the name is. Is it a Hebrew or is it an Aramaic name? Okay. I mentioned the father's name. There were those who want to insert the mother's name into Uksuba. That's one of the innovations. I mentioned the avant-garde wedding innovations. I'm opposed to it. But the fact that I'm opposed to it doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with the marriage. They're married, 100% married, and the Ksuba is 100% kosher. My opposition is based primarily on the fact that it was never done until now. And I'm not interested in changing things without a very important reason to change. My Rebbe was always insistent on what he called the Mishpachosam Leves Avosam, that families go by the fathers, a Pusik and Chumash. He was unhappy with those who are tampering with that. I was recently at a wedding where they put the father's name and the mother's name in at the insistence of the Chosn and Kala, and a certain rabbi refused to read the Ksuba, even though they told him you can leave out the mother's name when you read it. He refused to read it, period. So another rabbi got up and read the Ksuba and did not read the mother's name aloud. He skipped it. It was a compromise they reached. Listen, whenever you start making changes, you run into compromises. Yes?
But if you're saying
that
Ksuba is not much anymore, right?
Yeah!
I mean, so what's the...
Monkey can...
that's true.
If it's not irrelevant as much as it used to be, then...
The question is changes. The big question when it comes to these, what the avant-garde weddings is, changes. Because changes become, generate a perpetuation of more and more and more changes until you may actually get into situations which are halakhically problematic in a serious level in and of themselves, aside from the fact that it's just a plain change. So therefore, I've always been leery of these kinds of changes, and this was, when I grew up, there was never any, mother's name was never in the Ksuba, and so therefore, I'm not interested in changing it now. Yes?
But extending her point, I'm not sure why you're so worried about the spelling of the name. If a certain person said, I always spelled my name that way and I want it this way, something like that. On a get, where we use the kinuyim and all, you know, there it's very important to get the legal name of the person right so we know who it is.
Right.
But here, everybody knows who the chasen and kala is, and that's the way he said he spelled his name. If he wants to spell it wrong, good for him. Why is it so important to have the name proper?
You know, we always try to get the names right in a ksuba. Some say they may be used for a get, which is true. When this person comes for a get, let me see a ksuba. So we there are reasons to try to get it spelled right. We try to get it right. Okay. What about family names? So my preference is to leave them out for a variety of reasons. They're hard to spell, these long names. There could be issues with what is the family name? Not so clear. Someone is, you have step families or second marriages, or for a woman, or it makes complications. So I prefer to leave it out, although many people, in fact, put it in. Can you write the name of a stepfather or an adoptive father in a ksuba? So there are those who say, in certain cases, yes. They will add the word hamagadlo or hamagadlo. In other words, they'll say, A, the son or daughter of B, who raised her. Implying raised her, but he's not the biological father. Okay. What if it's a non-Jewish father? There are many cases like that. What do you do then? Put in the mother's name. See, here I'm a real feminist. The mother's name only. Because he has no father according to Jewish law. His father's not his father. His biological father, not a halachic father. So I would put in the mother's name. What? If both are not Jewish, and she's a Gioris.
Yes.
So a Gioris, a convert, you put Ben or Bas Avraham Avinu. That's the proper way to do it. Now, there are those who are adopted at birth, and no one knows about it. That's a big problem. What do you do about that? Nobody knows. It's kept a deep, dark secret. No one wants it. I've had these cases. So what I do in that case, so some people say, you know, they write down Bas Avraham Avinu, and they tell the guy, read Bas Chaim. Dangerous. First of all, they have these zooming lenses for the photographer, they'll pick up the, and then they make a mistake. I've done two ksubas. More discreet. The real ksuba and the so-called ksuba. The real ksuba, you come at the beginning of the ksuba, you know, they say, who else knows about this? One other rabbi. Good. We come early, for a change, you come early. And we sign the ksuba with Bas Avraham Avinu, give it to the chassan in his hands, and you give it to the kala and the yichud, That's the real ksub. Then we go through a charade, and that ksub I put in my pocket and it goes to the circular file, to the shredder. So that's what I've done in these kinds of circumstances. Fine. Now, the date is important. They're often situations of getting in between. You know, you're signing the ksuba, it's twilight zone, or you sign it by day and they get married by night, can cause certain halacha complications. The place, it's also interesting, where's the place? I had to find a place in Jewish law. So Gittin is a whole tumult about it, but ksuba always try to get it right. I mean, most of the weddings that we made for our children were in one place, in the atrium. And where's the atrium anyway? Is it, where is it? Exactly. So all the weddings we made say Spring Valley. Although others say Muncie. Now, if you go on the road over there, there's a sign which says Muncie going west after the atrium. And Spring Valley, if you're going east before the atrium, it indicates clearly it's in Spring Valley. But for other purposes, it's maybe Muncie. I would never disqualify a ksuba which said Muncie. Although I was once at a wedding of a very distinguished Talmud man, who's now a Rosh Hashiva. His grandfather was Messiah Kedushin. They wrote Muncie and they told him it was Spring Valley. He went into his car, got out the spare ksuba, and wrote a whole new one with Spring Valley in it, which was interesting. It means always bring a spare. That's an important lesson to be learned. Okay. If the father is a Kohen or a Levi, so you have to put down a Kohen or a Levi, the Chassan's name is mentioned in the Ksuba many times, the first and last with his father's name, and in between, just his name. The Kala's name is mentioned at the beginning and with her father's name, and once with only her name. So if he's a Kohen, how many times was the word Kohen be written? So we assume every single time. First it says Chaim ben Shimon a Kohen. The beginning and the end, it says Chaim a Kohen, Chaim a Kohen. The reason being, it's possible to be the son of a Kohen, but not be a Kohen. How can that be? Opposite of the famous joke. But how can that be? The answer is, if the father married a divorcee or a woman who wasn't allowed to marry, then this child is what we call a cholol, and he's not considered a Kohen. So to rule out that possibility, we put in HaKohen each time. HaLevi, technically speaking, it's not really required. Some suggest it's better to put in HaLevi because if the Levi married a woman who was an Erva, and produced a child who is a mamzer, chas v'shalom, he's not called a Levi. So there are those who go that far and require a Levi each time. I didn't do it. The last wedding we made, it's a Simcha's wedding, we put in a Levi for good measure. So since Baruch Hashem, Simcha's kosher, that means that presumably all of his brothers are kosher as well. But that's not, different rabbis have different policies as far as writing a Levi each time. Okay. Now, the classical ksuba that we have says besul toda. I mean, she's a virgin. And what if she's not? So the Rav Moshe Zatshuva, that if he is aware of that fact, which he should be made aware of, because it's not proper to fool the chosin, and he says, yeah, I don't care. I'm obligating myself to the greater sum of money that a ksuba is entitled to. It's okay. No problem. Moshe does say, and others say, if you live with a non-Jewish man, then it's better not to do it because of other technical issues, but that's not for this discussion. Okay. Now, there's one word that according to some authorities should be put in later on. It's what is vikonina. Vikonina means you pick up the handkerchief and the husband, by picking up, obligates himself to everything. It's a unilateral doctrine of the ksuba. Only obligations from the husband to the wife. The problem with that is the rabbi can forget it, they can smudge it, you name the problem, it's happened to me. The most famous case I had was a calligraphized ksuba going back 35 years, maybe even more, and they were so frum, not only did they leave out the word vikonina, they also left out the space to put in vikonina. Now what do you do? They left out the space. There's nowhere to put it. I know what I would have done. I would put it away. But it cost hundreds of dollars. So Rav Moshe was Masada Kedusha. Took out his pen had a carrot, put a vikanina, and the bottom he wrote, this word vikanina is here, and it's oh, it's a technical term, which means we acquired. We acquired on behalf of the kala from the chasm. It's just a word. It's an important word in the ksuba. I say, that ksuba is the most valuable ksuba around. It has Rav Moshe's handwriting on it. It's worth more than the amount of the ksuba, probably. It's all to the museum. But, okay. Calligraphized ksubas are...
Question.
Yes.
Okay, you said with the ksuba.
That's a totally that's a different. If a woman is divorced, it's a totally different ksuba. It's a smaller amount of money, and you write down matrachta, which means a divorced woman. It's a different kind of a ksuba completely. Okay. I believe strongly that the rabbi should fill out the ksuba in advance. It's filled out at the table. You know, the camera's flashing, the soda's spilling, the people are pushing. And they knock your elbow as you're writing it. I believe it's better to fill out in advance when there's no pressure. And again, as I said before, always bring an extra copy. Now, just for the next few minutes, discuss the wedding itself. I have advice for Chasam Kala. Take the pictures beforehand. All the pictures. By doing so, you are saving so many man hours and doing people such a favor. I've been at weddings. I was just at a wedding recently. Took over an hour and a half from the time that he broke his step, put his foot down on the glass till they showed up. An hour and a half, plus, more. It was crazy, you know. So that's what happens when the photographers are running the show. So if you take all the pictures in advance, you're saving it. You save an hour times as many people were there. If there are 500 people there, you're saving 500 man hours. Every man and woman can get an extra hour of sleep that night. I mean, it's. I remember Schneer Cutler once said, "Who gave them the right to take so long?" And that's how it is. So. I believe it's important. Yeah, the touching pictures, that can wait for later. That's a few pictures. That's.
But what about the chasam kala aren't supposed to see?
Where does it say that? Nowhere.
Where does that come from?
So, Aryeh Kaplan, if you want to read about weddings, the best book is of Aryeh Kaplan's book, Made in Heaven. He was he had an encyclopedic knowledge of the entirety of the entire corpus of Jewish law. The only quote he can give for that custom not to see you for a week. It's on the customs of Chabad, which means it's not anywhere.
I think the caterers made it up.
Yeah.
They get an extra
hour. So. Yeah. Over the band, the overtime. But the real reason is, it's a good. By the way, I like the custom.
Yeah.
All my children kept it, I kept it. It's a wonderful custom. Mm-hmm. It makes a lot of sense. But you know, it has to come to an end somewhere. So, you know, so when he sees about a bedekin, he's still before the wedding. So once he sees her an hour early to take pictures, what? So he says, oh, but it takes away the romantic. Because you're romantic, but that and you can waste 500 man hours? Please. So,
there are a lot of Hasidic weddings where they don't see each other from the engagement.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, right here.
But it comes to an end, you know? It comes to an end. Okay. When they break the plates, you know, by the Tanoim, don't take the plate out of the napkin. This one's a case. He took it out. It wouldn't break. And I think the chasam himself went to break it. And he slashed his wrist. Had to take off his stitches in Roosevelt Hospital. The Manhattan Hotel. And another thing, tell the chasam. Bring an extra shirt. The shirt was bloodied. So that was a unique case. But it happened. It happened. It happened. I didn't follow the case. Okay. The tanoim is done at the chosin's tish. That's where it's done. Traditionally, the kala doesn't have a tish. She sits in a throne. Everyone comes over to her. There's now a thing called the kala's tish in some places, which I'm not a fan of. Again, nothing intrinsically wrong with the kala's tish. It was never done before, so I'm. They sit around like the chosin's tish. I know a kala who finished shas at her wedding. Yeah, I'm very fond of this lady. She finished shas. It's new, you know. I'm just more of a traditionalist. So if I'm the Masada Kiddushin and the kalas want a tish, let them do the tish when I'm not there. In other words, they have an early tish, and I come in a little bit later when the kala is already move to the or on the way to the throne. Beautiful. Beautiful.
Okay.
Not okay. Great. Wonderful.
Because what happened was she davened longer than the Rosh Yeshiva.
Well, she was saying Vidui.
And they had to wait for her.
Oh, man. That's wild. That's wild. Okay. Okay. We have the Ksuba. I try to read the Ksuba together with the Chassan to make sure he knows what he's doing. And explain to him what's happening. And the witnesses sign it after. Okay. The Badekin. And the Badekin is a... cover, you give a bracha. Fathers, the grandfathers, they give a bracha. And then we go to the actual chuppah. However, I'm out of time. So, believe that. Next, I want to discuss the chuppah itself and the much more important topic. A Jewish wedding is not so hard. A Jewish marriage, that's for a lifetime. So again, we'll start off with thinking about the chuppah. We'll discuss some of the more modern chuppah innovations, and we'll talk about the Jewish marriage. We'll do that next week. Shavua Tov.